Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Orlando's on the bottom, Indiana's on the top, and no one's playing now. They'll watch the All-Star penny drop, as well as the slam dunking in a contest that's the best, although LeBron won't be there. If he was, he'd beat the rest. Joining me now for a less idiosyncratic take on the NBA's All-Star weekend and a consideration of the second half of the season is Eric Neal, who covers the NBA, among other things, for ESPN.com and ESPN the magazine. Eric, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks very much.
NBA fans are obviously focusing their attention on Los Angeles. That's where the All-Star game will occur. Is there a city better suited to host and hype a meaningless exhibition?
You know, it's right up there. One of my colleagues at ESPN, a guy named Mark Stein, actually suggested this week Las Vegas is the only better call. I think this year you got to say that it's pretty well suited to Los Angeles because the Lakers have been such a compelling story for reasons both good and bad.
Well, I want to get to that. But first of all, meaningless or not, the game will be played. What are you particularly looking forward to as far as the All-Star game is concerned?
I think most of the star powers on the western side of the ledger. I'm looking forward to seeing Kevin Garnett, Tim Duncan, and Yao Ming on the floor at the same time. On the eastern side, you know, it's always interesting to see Ben Wallace sort of in a throwback role. He's not your typical center, but he gets the starting nod on that side because he plays such ferocious defense and rebounds well.
Can you say defense and All-Star game in the same sentence?
Well, that's what I was just going to say. You know, sadly for Ben, that means about 3 minutes worth of action unless somebody in who's going to throw alley-oops. So.
All right, let's get back to the point you made about Los Angeles. Not much is going right for the Lakers these days. Everybody thought this was a sure bet for an NBA title team, and they're in fifth place in the Western Conference. Do injuries explain the whole story here?
Injuries are a major part of the story. You know, to have Shaquille, Kobe, and Karl Malone out at various times and for extended periods of time has been a significant blow to the team. But you've also got some pretty significant chemistry issues. Earlier in the season, once again, Kobe Bryant and Shaquille O'Neal were sort of going at each other. There's just recently been some indication that Kobe's also pretty unhappy with Phil Jackson. So there are a lot of chemistry issues on this team, and there always have been. They've been able to play through them in the past. This year, their hearts seem to not quite be in it, in addition to their bodies coming up short.
So the question becomes, do their hearts get into it over the second half of the season, and do the Lakers make another championship run despite these problems you've mentioned?
You know, I think they make a run, but I think it's an uphill climb for them. They're in the fifth spot now. We're talking about some very talented teams above them, and also, unfortunately for Lakers fans, some very talented teams below them this year. So even a first-round series is going to be a pretty dicey enterprise. I think they get close, but I suspect we're finally going to see a Sacramento championship.
Which of the other teams in the West do you like if the Lakers can't come on strong?
The team I'd be most intrigued in and hopeful for is Minnesota. They're getting just a marvelous year out of Sam Cassell, who probably should be the All-Star starter on Sunday. At the point guard position, Kevin Garnett is once again putting up MVP numbers. And Garnett's just such an intriguing player. He really has no analog anywhere in the league. There just isn't anyone who does the various things he does at such a high level. And they've come up short in the playoffs every year and have lost in the first round, so they've got a big monkey on their shoulders. And I think if they get past the first round and start to believe, they're going to be very dangerous.
Over in the East, the Nets caused some commotion recently when they fired their coach, Byron Scott. All he had done is lead them to two straight NBA Finals appearances, but the team then won nine games in a row under interim coach Lawrence Frank, tying an NBA record in that regard. So did the Nets make the right move?
Well, so far so good, huh? Lawrence Frank is clearly a genius.
All it takes is nine wins in a row.
I did a little bit of research. There have been two other coaches who started off this hot. Kurt Rambis, who took over with the Lakers at one point, and I'm pretty sure I could have coached him to nine wins in a row with the team they had on the floor. And the legendary Buddy Jeanette, who also led the 47-48 Baltimore Bullets to a 9-0 record when he first took over. We're going to hope for Lawrence Frank that he hangs around longer than either of those two guys. I don't know if they made the right call. I think Frank's an interesting guy. He's one of these guys who sort of makes a career decision very early to be a full-time NBA guy. And I think more than anything, what you have is Jason Kidd playing with a song in his heart.
With the 9 wins in a row, the Nets are the hottest team in the East. They are not the best team in the East. The Pacers have the best record not only in the East but in the whole league. Can anybody in the Eastern Conference prevent the Pacers from getting to the finals?
I don't think so. The Pacers are incredibly strong, very physical, play terrific defense, and they have in Jermaine O'Neal probably the best O'Neal in the NBA right now, which is saying something. I have a hard time imagining anybody taking them. New Orleans will play them tight, perhaps. Detroit could give them a run, but I think they're the class of the conference by a long shot.
Eric Neal is a columnist who covers the NBA for ESPN.com and ESPN, the magazine. Eric, thank you again.
Thank you, Bill.
At the All-Star break, it is still too early in the NBA season for confident predictions, but it's safe to say the Los Angeles Clippers won't win the championship. On the other hand, it also seems safe to say that fans won't end up regarding this season's Clippers as a joke, and for a franchise that has bounced between futility and haplessness for years, that constitutes progress. At a shoot-around preceding last week's game with the Celtics in Boston, Mike Dunleavy, who took over the Clippers as head coach this season, explained why Clippers fans should be feeling encouraged.
Well, I think it's a team that tries to play aggressive offensively. We try to push the ball up and down the floor. We're trying to score points. We're up to the top of the ladder as far as points scored is concerned. Unfortunately, we're the same way on points allowed, and then we're trying to get better as a defensive team. We're virtually in most every game, in tight games, and that's the first step in the right direction.
A skeptic might respond that a team as bad as the Clippers have been over the past 20 years could hardly help but stumble into the right direction at some point, if not by design, then by default. Since 1981, when current owner Donald Sterling bought the team, the Clippers have finished under 500 19 times. In 13 of those seasons, they finished last in their division, and in one of them, 1986-87, they went a remarkable 12-70. Even lottery finishes haven't helped. The Clippers have used their high draft picks to acquire three types of players: those who couldn't play after all, those who only wanted to play somewhere else, and those who got hurt. Nearly 20 years ago, after helping the Boston Celtics win a couple of championships and then irritating ownership, Cedric Maxwell was banished to the Clippers. A radio broadcaster now with the Celtics, he still remembers what it was like to play for the second-best team in Los Angeles.
JV, on the JV team. How was it like being in the NBA? So it was disheartening. First five or six games of the season, we played really well. We were 6-0 or something. We were leading the league. It was great. And all of a sudden, that Clipper curse kicked in, and we had everybody got hurt all at one time, and just really changed the whole season for us. It always seems like there's something when you're a Clipper land.
No wonder that in those days, and in lots of other days before and since Maxwell's tenure with the Clippers, players unfortunate enough to find themselves in Clippers uniforms were anxious to be traded somewhere, anywhere else. Beyond the problems associated with sharing a building with the Lakers and a historically inept front office, Clippers ownership consistently failed to re-sign top players. But recently, as Coach Dunleavy notes, the Clippers have been trying to keep their best players around.
Well, I think that's true. I think, last summer, by giving Elton Brand a max contract and matching the contract Corey Maggette received from Utah, and the fact is that we have a bunch of money for this summer, and I think that, you know, we're looking to use it to, make ourselves a lot better.
The player who's perhaps most important to the eventual success of the Clippers agrees. Elton Brand, the aforementioned beneficiary of a 5-year contract, has a legitimate gripe about not being included on the All-Star team. He's good enough to have some of the L.A. press calling him Mini Shaq. Brand doesn't much like the fact that the Clips are still looking up at 5 teams in the Pacific Division, but conversations that he's had with players on opposing teams have made him optimistic.
It's a great sense of things moving in the right direction. You just see it around the league. You know, a lot of free agents. You know, I'm not going to say any names, but you know, they come up to me after the game and save some of that cap space. And, you know, we want to come here. And, you know, it's surprising because, you know, I've been here. This is my third year. And I haven't heard that any of the other years. But, you know, I guess my contract, Corey McGetty's contract, they see that guys are getting paid, you know, L.A., and they see what we're doing, that we're winning some games and we're playing pretty well.
Mike Dunleavy, a veteran of head coaching stints with the Lakers, Bucks, and Trailblazers before he took over the Clippers, would doubtless approve of Elton Brand's attitude. Though when asked what would constitute a success this season, his goals seem modest.
Well, I think, I mean, 500 would be a great level to be at for us. I'm not sure that would get us into the playoffs, probably doubtful. But that would be a good first step. And like I said, our point differential is only 2 points right now. So it's you know, two less mistakes a game and you maybe have a win.
The 22-29 Clippers, dare we say the new improved Clippers, will next pursue a win in Portland against the Trailblazers on Wednesday night. On Thursday, four men associated with the Bay Area Laboratory Cooperative, known as BALCO, were charged in a 42-count indictment for providing illegal performance-enhancing drugs to track and field athletes, as well as to pro football and baseball players. All four have pleaded not guilty. The charges include conspiracy to distribute steroids, misbranding drugs with intent to defraud, and money laundering. If convicted on all counts, the defendants could face prison terms and hundreds of thousands of dollars in fines. Dozens of athletes, including Barry Bonds of the San Francisco Giants and sprinter Marion Jones, testified before a grand jury late last fall about the activities of the laboratory. An examination of BALCO's trash turned up checks and thank you notes from current NFL and Major League Baseball players, as well as one check for $7,350 from an Olympic gold medalist. It's 18 minutes past the hour. If you're a lass looking for an unusual way to suggest marriage to a fellow who enjoys rugby, folks at the Famous Grouse, a rugby side in Scotland, want to hear from you quickly. Officials at the team, which will play in Cardiff, Wales today, are looking for a woman who will propose to the gentleman of her choice at halftime on the stadium's giant screens before 72,000 fans. Famous Grouse spokesperson Carol McLaren says of the potential husband, quote, "We'll make sure his mates are in on the surprise and we'll have someone with a microphone handy to get his answer, which will hopefully be yes," end quote. Yeah, it wouldn't muck up Valentine's Day if the guy said, "What are you, nuts?" I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, the week's news with Charlie Pierce. But first, after more than 30 years of team ownership, Major League Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig and his family may soon be severing their ties with the Milwaukee Brewers. Selig's daughter and Brewers board chairwoman Wendy Selig Preeb recently announced that the club is up for sale. But some question whether the commissioner's involvement in the sale constitutes a conflict of interest. From Milwaukee, Wisconsin Public Radio's Chuck Quirnbach reports.
Bud Selig became a Milwaukee hero when he brought the Brewers in from Seattle 34 years ago. His popularity peaked in 1982 when the team made its only trip to the World Series.
The 1-2 pitch, ball lined to out, it's short, he throws, it's over! The Brewers have won the American League pennant! Milwaukee, you have a World Series!
Brewers went on to lose the 1982 World Series in 7 games to the St. Louis Cardinals. The Brewers have posted losing records for more than a decade, and controversy over the public funding of Miller Park Stadium has tarnished Bud Selig's image in Milwaukee. That's even though he gave up a direct financial stake in the Brewers when he became baseball commissioner in 1992. At a recent Brewers promotional event at a suburban Milwaukee shopping mall, parents watched their kids whip 40-mile-an-hour fastballs past a radar gun. But some of the parents here wouldn't mind subjecting Bud Selig and Wendy Selig Preeb to a little chin music. One fan who identifies herself as Beth says she'd welcome the Brewers' sale.
Because the Seligs have done a really crummy job, and hopefully someone else can do a little better. We actually get a team in here.
Over at a virtual batting cage, another parent is more forgiving of the Selig family. But Pat says it is time for Bud Selig to have Wendy choose a buyer.
I think she did an admirable job. The team just hasn't gone in that right direction. So I think selling the team, just as long as it stays here, which I think they do have a contract where they're not going to leave, that can be good. Good for the community.
The Seligs have promised to sell to new owners who will keep the Brewers in Milwaukee. But some other questions about the potential sale are less clear. Namely, can Bud Selig, who has his 26% ownership stake in a trust fund controlled by two Brewers board members, avoid a conflict of interest in judging a purchase offer? Milwaukee Journal Sentinel sports business writer Don Walker says Selig has to serve two masters.
As commissioner, he has to get the best price, or at least he hopes he does. He wants to keep the franchise levels as pricing levels as high as possible. So that's one master he has to sell. The other is himself. You have the right person that you want to run the Milwaukee Brewers and, most important, of course, keep them in Milwaukee.
Walker says some people are very unhappy with Selig's track record in facilitating franchise sales. When the Boston Red Sox were sold in 2002, Walker says many suspected that Selig favored John W. Henry's ownership group because it agreed with Selig's desire for greater revenue sharing between teams.
The Boston media immediately leaped on this and accused the commissioner of expressing some favoritism toward the group that he selected. Bud himself, as recently as 2 or 3 weeks ago, vigorously denied that and said that was not the case. But the perception, it continues to linger in Boston.
Selig declined to be interviewed for this story, but Major League Baseball has downplayed any potential conflict in Selig's role as commissioner and Brewers co-owner. Back at the Brewers promotional event, diehard fans disagree on Bud Selig's ability to fairly oversee the sale of the team.
He's got to step back and let the others kind of decide on how the sale goes for them.
I'm not one of those people that believes that Bud Selig's an evil person. I believe Bud Selig's going to do what's best for the Brewers and what's best for Major League Baseball, and I think those two things aren't necessarily opposite of each other.
He's got a lot more power than he admits. He's still telling his daughter what to do.
For Only a Game, I'm Chuck Pernbach in Milwaukee.
Silent Thunder, subtitled Breaking Through Cultural, Racial, and Class Barriers in Motor Sports, is essentially the story of the sometimes exhilarating and often thoroughly frustrating career of Leonard W. Miller. Mr. Miller's experience in the world of automobile racing includes everything from driving friends around at preposterous speeds when he was a youngster to cobbling together the sponsors, drivers, and mechanics necessary to the maintenance of a competitive racing team made up of African Americans. Leonard Miller joins me now from the studios of WRTI in Philadelphia. Mr. Miller, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I gather that your mother was not thrilled at your very early fascination with fast cars.
She was not thrilled because we had a tremendous cultural problem. She wanted her children to grow up, go to college, get a white-collar job because most black kids in those days, and white kids for that matter, 50% did not graduate from high school.
Mm-hmm.
And she wanted me to better my life and not fool around with old dirty cars.
You make the point that while a youngster who devotes himself to being a great basketball player may come out of that process with no marketable skills, a guy who devotes himself to competitive racing will almost certainly develop mechanical and perhaps business skills as well. Has that proved to be a convincing argument?
That is a convincing argument once you go into the black community and explain it. Because most of the folks in the black community have no understanding of the culture of racing. For example, the Daytona 500 is coming up this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Those pit crew fellas that jump over the wall, Some of them make $60,000 or $70,000 a year. A race car driver can get hurt, and at 50 or 55 years old, he can paint cars, he can weld, he can do all kinds of things. Or NBA players either are broke or someone's leading them around by the nose.
Eventually, you moved into the business end of racing. You found yourself a terrific black driver so you could compete on the Formula Super V's circuit. But according to one of your sponsors, Viceroy, that driver, whose name was Benny Scott, was married to the wrong woman. Have I got that essentially right?
You got it exactly right. This was in the 1974, and at that time, the interracial marriage problem was a big on the horizon, and they told me in no uncertain terms, the advertising agency executive in charge, and said, Leonard, we're not giving you any money until you switch drivers. And I said, why? And then he told me the story of a black man in Long Island, New York, had these antique cars, and he wanted his wife to be in one of the pictures, and the lady came out with a bouffant blonde. And they were in shock, and they shot all the scenes with empty cameras, and they wasted $50,000 and went home, and he said, the same thing's going to happen to you.
In other words, Benny Scott was a fine driver. If he'd been married to a black woman, nobody would have had a problem.
The answer is yes.
Yeah.
And what I did, and being loyal to Benny because I didn't like that type of situation, we turned around, and we entered our own car out of our own pocket against the Viceroy car driven by Randy Bethea.
And I have to ask you who won.
Benny Scott was a better driver.
There you go. Lots of people associate auto racing with the South, but a lot of your experience came at tracks in Pennsylvania and in New Jersey, and at one track in Flemington, New Jersey, I gather the racism was especially brutal.
The racism was brutal. It was in 1980, and Bruce Driver won the New Jersey State Dirt Track Championship, and they did not want a black driver to represent the racetrack in the Syracuse National Dirt Finals. They changed all of the records at the end of the race in about 3 minutes, and they made Billy Cannon, the second-place driver, the winner, which was very crushing, bro, and I didn't expect that in New Jersey.
In other words, they basically skewed the results and said, okay, even though this guy finished first, as far as we're concerned, he didn't.
It's like being in a mafia meeting. That's what it was like. It was that bad.
Though it didn't surprise me that individuals shouted insults at members of your racing team, I was surprised at how frequently members of the racing establishment at various levels in various competitive categories conspired against you. What was the damage that racing bureaucrats felt that they would suffer if a black team did win?
They were dealing with myth, institutional racism, not knowing how black driver would be treated by the fans, so they did not venture out. It's a very conservative community, very conservative.
It's interesting that you speak in the present tense, not it was a very conservative community, but it is a very conservative community. Is that still very much the case?
It is very much the case. In the last chapter of Silent Thunder, we bring out the experience at Coastal Plains Speedway in Jackson, North Carolina, where Morty Buckles, and we were sponsored by Dr. Pepper, gave them their first corporate win. A tremendous racism, but not from the officials. The officials stood up for us, but it was so bad they thought at first that the sheriff will have to escort us out of the track, and that was something I wasn't ready for. That was in 2001. And one of the things that hurt me more than anything that night was an 8-year-old Southern kid had his nose up against the fence, and he said, "You people, go home." I looked up, and I heard it, and I saw him, and I said, "My goodness, we got to go through another 25 or 50 years of this racial problem."
The world of auto racing is, I gather, full of characters. One of the more colorful people you describe is a guy known as Heavy, who would, as I understand it, buy the most expensive car that he could find just to make a point?
Yes, Brooklyn Heavy was in the underworld type way of doing things at Bedford-Stuyvesant in the middle of Brooklyn, New York. where the police didn't even go near his neighborhood. It was like New Jack City, and he was really a character, and I have a great story in the book. In fact, one movie studio that's been looking at the book had said that scene they want to put in the movie.
Well, in case you can tempt somebody toward the book, maybe you better just briefly outline that scene for us with all its cinematic possibilities.
All right. Ron Hines and I, a great black mechanic and engineer, went down to see Brooklyn Heavy so he could enter his three pro-stock NHRA race cars at a Black American Racers race day in Englishtown, New Jersey. We go down into the neighborhood. It's real eerie. It's just like being in Fort Apache in the Bronx. And a big 6'9" power forward-looking guy came out, and he said, "Halt." He was the policeman. That was the policeman in the area. And he led us to Brooklyn Heavy. We went in to sit down and talk. There was a commotion outside. And the fellow had a brand-new Oldsmobile 88, a man in the neighborhood. I didn't know whether he was legal or illegal type, but he had this thing and pulled it in the shop. And Heavy said, "Hold it, Miller." He said, "What's going on here?" He went outside, and he saw this 88. He said, You keep that car here a minute. I will be back." And the guy said, "Guard Miller, whatever you do, guard Miller. Don't let anybody, you know, bother me."
So you felt protected.
Yeah, because I look like the FBI in there. I mean, the way I was dressed, it was a while. He came back an hour later with a Cadillac, brand new Cadillac with everything on it. He told this young, pretty girl looking like Foxy Brown. He said, "Read what's on that old." And she read it. He said, "Read what's on the sticker of this Cadillac." She read it. And he said, "Who the king?" That's how he said, "Who the king?" Everybody said, "Heavy, you're the king." And he says, "Don't you come in here again, because I am the king." And I was shocked. I mean, it was like it was out of a movie scene, you know.
And it's going to be in a movie if you have any luck.
Yes, yes,
excellent.
Yes. And he was a good guy, though, and he did come down to the racetrack. But that was wild.
In 1989, you changed the name of your racing team, which had been Black American Racers Incorporated, to Bruce Driver Miller. Why the change?
When you put a proposal into large corporations' hands, the Black American Racers logo didn't carry to the top of the pile anymore. In the 70s, when there was a big push to push Black racers and race teams forward, people would say, "Oh, there's Black American Racers. What is that? What is that?" So they would go to the bottom of the pile. I mean, that was right after Martin Luther King marched. Civil rights was at its peak. And when you said Black, anything dealing with Black, people would take an honest look at it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In 1989, that was waning, so we went back to what we originally were, you know, Miller Racing.
You mention at several points in Silent Thunder that Jackie Robinson is your particular sports idol. Do you feel that ultimately you achieved some of the same things for minorities who would enter auto racing that Jackie Robinson achieved for minorities in baseball and minorities at large?
Yes, with three drivers, with Benny Scott, Tommy Thompson, and Bruce Driver, I accomplished maybe three-fifths of what Jackie Robinson accomplished. You know, we haven't won the Daytona 500, which is this weekend. We have not won the Indianapolis 500. So if we won those two races, I'd say we had accomplished what Jackie Robinson would want us to accomplish.
Leonard W. Miller is the author of Silent Thunder, Breaking Through Cultural, Racial, and Class Barriers in Motorsports, published by the Red Sea Press, available March 1st. Mr. Miller, thank you very much for joining me.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Hotel Commonwealth Boston, located in the Fenway Park neighborhood, near historic mansions, universities, medical institutions, and cultural sites. Information at hotelcommonwealth.com. This is NPR, National Public.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, American tennis fans drink heartily from the Davis Cup, they hope. But first, the week's news with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Charlie, start your engines. The Daytona 500 will run tomorrow. Who do you like in the race?
You're asking me to pick the Daytona?
Absolutely.
You're asking me to pick America's race? I will go with Dale Earnhardt Jr.
Mm-hmm.
Why? I have no idea. His Framistad is in good shape, and his battle out, and he's got a great setup.
Good setup. That's the key. Looking further down the road, or perhaps further around the oval, what should we look for over the course of this NASCAR season?
A lot of people driving very fast, making left-hand turns.
There you go. Simple. On Thursday night, LSU women's basketball coach Sue Gunter earned her 700th win. Now she trails only Pat Summitt and Jody Conrad in coaching wins. She may actually have more than 700, she says. What's this all about?
Well, first of all, congratulations to Sue, and I'm so sorry she couldn't be at the game. She's got bronchitis and a viral infection. She had to miss her 700th win. She was officially credited with 699 wins going into the game against Arkansas, but the first 6 years of her 40-year career wasn't included for reasons that nobody can quite figure out. The biggest one is that the first 4 years of her 16-year run at Stephen F. Austin isn't listed in the media guide.
Well, people weren't paying a whole heck of a lot of attention to women's
basketball. But somebody should have been counting. I mean, they had records.
St. Joseph's is currently ranked number 3 in men's basketball. I don't know how they could do better than 21-0 and why they're not number 1, but they're number 3. Are we looking at an undefeated season?
I think you're looking at a team that's going to be undefeated, at least going into their conference tournament. The only real bump in the road for them that I could see was playing Dayton at Dayton, and they beat them the other night. The conference isn't that strong. Anyone can stumble in a conference tournament, which also will take place at Dayton, by the way. But it's very possible that we will see at least one undefeated team going into the NCAA tournament this year.
Meanwhile, St. John's University, whose men's college basketball program was one game away from the Final Four 5 years ago, would appear to be in serious trouble. Player suspensions and scandal had the school president, the Reverend Donald Harrington, saying this week that he will not suspend the program. That means at some point that he had said that he probably would, I guess. What has happened there over the last few years?
Well, obviously, and a lot of this has to trace back to deposed coach Mike Jarvis, but the NCAA term of art is lack of institutional control. These people apparently had a profound lack of bed check control at its most basic.
You will be surprised to learn, I'm sure, that Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban has been barking about league policy. He's not crazy about NBA players competing in the Olympics, perhaps because he has more to lose in that regard than most NBA owners.
He has a point, and he doesn't have a point, and I guarantee you he's the only one saying out loud what a lot of NBA owners are thinking in their hearts. He has, of course, Steve Nash, who plays for Canada, Dirk Nowitzki, who plays for Germany, Eduardo Nájera, who plays for Mexico, and, you know, who knows whether Michael Finley or whoever would play for the United States. He said that if it's important for me to play for my country, I'm not going to sign the contract. Namely, if you sign a contract with the NBA, your first obligation is to your NBA team, and therefore you shouldn't risk injury playing for your national team. I mean, it can just as easily be turned around on Mark Cuban saying, if you're going to hire players from around this great globe of ours, you're going to run into this problem more than most folks are.
The NHL is at it again, or perhaps I should say at it still. This week, the league presented new numbers, which it says indicate the loss of $270 million. Will this report change anybody's mind about the NHL's financial situation?
No, because the the NHL has hired what it calls an independent auditor. Of course, unfortunately, when the reputation of independent auditors aren't what they were before Enron.
It's not great.
And if the National Hockey League, which is mired in a vicious and soon-to-be devastating labor confrontation, hires an auditor, he's not independent anymore.
Can it be coincidence that at the same time the movie about the 1980 U.S. Olympic hockey team arrives, the guy who has the puck, allegedly, from the goal that beat the Russians has announced that said puck is for sale at roughly 7 times what he paid for it?
Yes, this Mark Friedland guy bought the puck last year for $13,000, $13,200 at auction. The asking price for it now is $95,000, which I'm sure has not, you would be shocked to learn it probably has to do with the release of the movie. Of course, the 25th anniversary of that particular game is until next year. But the interesting thing for me about Mr. Friedland says he's using the money to fund other recent purchases, including Rocket Richard's 1950s All-Star uniform.
Yeah, that's
it's
pretty
great.
Good.
It's great to see some respect for the classics.
Charlie, brawls, of course, are common enough in the National Hockey League, but goalies seldom get involved in the fisticuffs. They usually stand in padded splendor and watch. But I gather Wednesday night's game in Edmonton gave fight fans their money's worth and much more.
The principals were Ty Conklin of the Edmonton Oilers and Pasi Nurminen of the Atlanta folks, who got together at Center Ice and laid pads and sticks and, and large protective devices on each other to the roaring cheers of the several people who were at the game.
I presume nobody was hurt. I mean, these guys are seriously covered up.
It's impossible to hurt. You could run these guys over with a Zamboni and not hurt them.
The goalie controversy in Detroit has been resolved, at least temporarily. Dominik Hasek said this week that he's through for the season. Do you like his chances to come back next fall at the age of 40?
I like his chances of finding somebody who'll take the chance on him coming back at the age of 40. He's still one of the best goalies in the world. I think this will make people slightly more reluctant, but he'll find a job.
His replacement, by the way, got hurt the next night, so maybe the controversy isn't entirely resolved.
No, that's true.
Lots of Americans were upset 2 months ago when Mexico beat the U.S. baseball team and knocked it out of the 2004 Olympic competition. On Tuesday night, Mexico's under-23 soccer team knocked off the U.S. side, which means the U.S. won't be playing men's soccer in Athens either. So you want my plane tickets?
The air has just gone out of the Olympics for you, hasn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. Well, the women will still be playing. It'll be all right.
I bow to no one in my ignorance of soccer, and I'm not that I'm proud of it. It's just the way things are. 4-0 is a serious, a serious kicking of the American hindquarters.
It was not exactly a squeaker. Finally, Charlie, our derision and criticism notwithstanding, the Lingerie Bowl was apparently a big hit during Super Bowl halftime, and apparently there are many who feel that a lingerie football league would be a sheer pleasure. I promise I didn't write that. I just read it. All right, take the ball and run with it.
What do people wear in the stands at lingerie bowl games?
I don't even want to think about
it. I mean, they obviously don't wear jerseys.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me at this time each week for Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill. And I just have that sort of New York euphoria.
For more on this week's stories, pictures from stories past and present, commentaries galore, and the opportunity to write email to us, check out our website, onlyagame.org. At 10 o'clock yesterday morning, the Boston Celtics put forward Vin Baker on waivers, meaning that Baker became available to any NBA team wishing to assume his $30 million contract. The Celtics might be charitably characterized as rebuilding this season, though they might be more accurately described as falling apart. The departure of one player from a bad team wouldn't normally be news. But Vin Baker's appearance on the waiver wire comes with baggage. Baker is an alcoholic. Drinking put him on the bench last season, and then it put him in a rehab facility. In November, Baker played like a man who'd rediscovered himself as a force, scoring and rebounding as if he had something to prove. At one point, he led the league in field goal percentage. He said all the right things, and no doubt he meant them. He seemed to be one of the most encouraging pro sports stories of any season. But in January, after his play had begun to deteriorate, a series of tests indicated that Vin Baker was drinking again. The Celtics have played this one by the book. The team placed Baker on waivers only after he botched the fourth and final chance to which he was entitled, according to league rules regarding players abusing substances. Perhaps another team will claim Baker. Almost certainly the Players Association will take up his cause. But the more significant concern will be whether Vin Baker can become a recovering alcoholic again. Yesterday morning, Boston Globe sports columnist Michael Holley suggested that since Baker, quote, gets a lot of his self-worth from playing basketball, he may have even more trouble outside the game than he had while he was playing. On the other hand, unburdened by the requirements of work in the NBA, not to mention the flash and dazzle, Vin Baker may find that he can concentrate on his sobriety, which is, as any recovering alcoholic will testify, a lot more important than points, rebounds, and salary to one's sense of self-worth. In Michael Holley's column, former NBA star and coach John Lucas, himself a recovering addict, characterizes alcoholism as, quote, a demon that never takes a day off and always wants you back. At this point, Vin Baker's story constitutes a warning that the demon can take down even a 6'11", 250-pound multimillionaire power forward. I hope the sequel to Baker's seasons in Boston will demonstrate that he's one of many, many determined recovering alcoholics who can learn to keep the demon out of his or her life, not for the sake of career or money, but for the sake of himself or herself, one day at a time.
And now, representing the United States of America,
remember when tennis matches were characterized by white clothes, whispers, and etiquette? Last weekend's Davis Cup match between the U.S. and Austria, held at the arena at the Mohegan Sun Casino in Uncasville, Connecticut, featured music both live and canned, a competitor in a red sleeveless shirt, even groupies of a sort, named Amanda, Marcia, and Ashley.
We just love Andy Roddick. He's the best tennis player.
At Sunday's matches, Amanda, Marcia, and Ashley wore T-shirts that, as long as they didn't change seats, spelled out, Go Roddick. But they hastened to point out that they had nothing against the other U.S. singles player, the one in the sleeveless red shirt, Robbie Ginepri. They were wearing his name on their backs. Amanda, Marcia, and Ashley were more demonstrative than some of the other fans, but perhaps no more impressed. A recreational player named Larry, who'd driven to the matches from Providence, Rhode Island, was also inspired by Andy Roddick.
I think 150-mile-an-hour serve will inspire anyone. I think we need more Andy Roddicks in men's tennis.
More guys hitting the serve 150 miles an hour?
And playing with the passion that he plays with.
The passion was evident as Roddick won singles matches on Friday and Sunday over Jürgen Melzer and Stefan Kubek, respectively. Robbie Ginepri won both of his singles matches as well, and the U.S. doubles team of Bob and Mike Bryan was also victorious. The defeated Austrians had to find their solace where they could. After he lost in straight sets on Sunday, Stefan Kubek smiled when he was asked if he'd enjoyed getting one of the biggest ovations of the afternoon. The roar of appreciation had come when Kubek ended what looked like a futile chase of a Roddick shot by returning it backwards between his legs for a ridiculously unlikely winner.
I felt pretty good. I mean, honestly, I don't have this shot, but I made it, so I was really happy to play like the best point of the weekend.
Some on hand might have taken issue with that call. They may have regarded any one of Andy Roddick's 150-mile-an-hour deliveries, perhaps particularly the one he launched on a second serve at the end of Sunday's match, as the point of the weekend, but no matter. The final result was 5-0, and at the post-match press conference, U.S. team captain Patrick McEnroe was looking forward to the April quarterfinal match against the Swedish team. The Swedes upset the Australians over the weekend, and McEnroe cautioned everybody to expect a struggle.
Sweden is very tough. I mean, they have a great tradition in Davis Cup. The last time they played us, they beat us 5-0 in Davis Cup. these guys personally don't remember that, but I'll try to remind them of it over the next couple months, that that happened in the Davis Cup final.
A successful Davis Cup run is obviously Patrick McEnroe's first concern, but he's certainly aware that his first singles player, Andy Roddick, has also been anointed as the great young hope of men's tennis in these days when lots of fans seem to care more about the women's side of the game. Captain McEnroe doesn't mind the baggage.
I certainly see it as a huge positive, and Andy has a tremendous passion for tennis and for competition and for being out there, and he understands the big picture and that that tennis is entertainment at some level. In addition to him being just an innate, great competitor, he's a bit of a performer, but in a positive way. He understands that people are coming out, they want to be entertained. He loves to be out there.
And Amanda, Marcia, and Ashley, among others, love to have him out there. For his part, the passionate and powerful Andy Roddick himself shrugged off the idea that being the standard bearer for the return of excitement to men's tennis constitutes uncomfortable pressure.
There's always pressure. That's what professional sports is about. I'm excited that I have the opportunity maybe to reach out and maybe bring new tennis fans in. If I can make a difference as an individual, I mean, we don't have an individual sport. I've said it before, we don't have a huge marketing team behind us doing it, so I think it's up to the players to promote the game, and I'm happy with that responsibility.
As he takes on that responsibility, Andy Roddick has a fan in Davis Cup teammate Robbie Ginepri. He may also have a rival.
Andy's great with the crowd, you know, with the big serve, and he's very hyperactive on the court, and by me wearing the sleeveless shirt, that gives another thing that the crowd looks for, and there's all good reasons, and I think the men's tennis game will pick back up.
Obviously, it will delight Robbie Ginepri if Patrick McEnroe fields the same lineup when the U.S. meets Sweden in the Davis Cup quarterfinals 2 months hence. Andy Roddick would seem to be a lock, as would the doubles team of Brian and Brian, and the 21-year-old Ginepri certainly didn't hurt his chances when he came from two sets down to win his Friday match, something he'd never done before as a pro, further enhancing his own credentials as a guy capable of rebuilding enthusiasm for men's tennis. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Boris Strapochki and from Joe Patti at WRTI in Philadelphia. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, or perhaps sign up for the Only a Game newsletter, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Boston Celtics cast-off Cedric Maxwell, who describes what it was like to be introduced to the fans of L.A. for the first time as a Clipper.
You would have thought that, you know, the guy Gone with the Wind had just come in and slapped Scarlett or something, because it was ugly.
Yeah, but not as ugly as when that guy Star Wars was killed by Darth Vader. I'm Only a Game. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week here on Bill Littlefield. What?
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.